Bernard Cornwell, author of many books, 40, I think, now The Last Kingdom, which will be the first of many books exploring, well, maybe I'll let you say what it explores, and then please move to this question that Bill raises about that context in a time when the context is so different. How comfortable do you feel in creating?
Well, are we different?
And it goes to getting inside people's heads, and that part, because this is essentially a first-person narrative, and to get inside somebody in a context that is in many ways very alien, in a lot of ways it's not, would seem to be a challenge.
How do you do
and,
that?
And in some ways more difficult than the history you were talking about.
Yeah.
I think that's true, and the first thing to say is I don't believe people change at all, and that 4,000 years ago, what people wanted is much what people want today.
It's also a blink in evolutionary
it is.
Time.
But the appetites and the drives are the same. But the context is wholly and hugely and totally different, and that, of course, is going to have an enormous effect. So it's important to understand the context. And I think probably the most important thing about that, and it doesn't really matter whether you're talking about a time of building Stonehenge or the Roman Empire or the time of Alfred the Great, you're talking about a pre-technological, pre-scientific society, and the only explanation they have got for disasters, whether it's a failed harvest or a dead child or whatever, a flood, whatever it is supernatural. They might have called it religious, we would call it supernatural. And our context changed wholly when we began to understand what were the causes of these things. As I say, I now live on Cape Cod, and 2 weeks ago we had 3 feet of snow. Now, we know what causes the snow. We don't immediately rush out and start offering our wives and daughters to the gods to placate them so they don't send more. But 2,000 years ago they might have done. And that's a very rational reaction, not if you're the wife or daughter, of course. But it is a rational reaction to actually try and control the whatever forces there are that affect your life. So I think to understand those forces is what the job of the historical or the historian is to do.
I was charmed in The Last Kingdom. I was delighted to see the rubbing together of two very different religious worldviews, if you will, to see the Celtic, the ancient nature driven religion coming against what the Romans had brought in with the Christian tradition, and you do this so wonderfully inside the heads of your characters, to see how it was the same and how it was different. Did you have fun finding that and then writing that? You didn't just make that up.
No, none of that's made up, and it's very much a follow-up to what I did in the three books on Arthur. But in this time, of course, I mean, here we are, we have Wednesday, Thursday in our week. These are remnants of the old religion of the Saxons and the Danes.
Woden and Thor, I suppose.
And Eostre and Freya and Ran and Jord and Hel, all sorts of... In other words, they are a polytheistic religion. And a very, very fatalistic religion. They probably don't really believe the gods have that much interest in what goes on Earth. But if you tick the gods off, then wham, you're going to be hit. And this, I mean, I don't know if you accept that the sort of evolution of religion goes from polytheism to henotheism to monotheism, then it's a less advanced religion than Christianity.
Or maybe it's the other way around.
Comes up against Christianity, and it's doomed to lose.
Doomed?
It's doomed to lose. And I think the reason for that is this. When the Romans left Britain, there were two major contenders for religion in Britain. One was Christianity, the other was Mithraism. And this is a straightforward contest here, and Mithraism is going to lose. It's going to lose because it's a man's religion. Mithraism is for soldiers.
We don't hear about Mithraism.
But there are more Mithraic temples from the Roman period than there are Christian. When the Romans left, Christianity won and was winning even before that. And the same thing is going to happen with the Danes. Although the Danes do have goddesses, and although the Danish religion, as much as we can understand it, was made a space for women in it, Christianity is an entirely female-centric religion. You don't think that. We think of it as being paternal, and things like the Da Vinci Code try and make out that the whole thing is, in fact, a paternalistic plot. It's not true. What Christianity did, it appealed to women. And women are the transmitters of culture in a society. And the religion you learn as a child is the religion your mother teaches you. Much less what your father teaches you. And Christianity appealed to women. There is a theory that Christianity was basically spread by women. Now, women may have picked the wrong religion. Maybe they should have picked a religion which had a goddess instead of a god. I mean, that's another argument altogether. But the Danes, when they come into contact with Christianity, they very quickly, surprisingly quickly, lose their religion and get turned over to Christianity. And part of that, again, I think, comes from the fact they took a lot of Saxon women captive, and those Saxon women who had children to Danes brought their children up as Christians.
And why do you think it is that it's so appealing to women?
It offers salvation for all. Mithraism really only offers salvation to soldiers, male soldiers. Under the Danish system, which is, again, really very weird, if you died in battle, life wasn't too bad, right? Because you got sort of picked up by a Valkyrie, and you were whipped off to Valhalla, to the corpse hall, and you spent your time there eating, drinking, feasting, having women supplied for your enjoyment, and you fought every day. And if you lost and you got killed, it didn't matter because you were resurrected that same day to get back to the feast hall.
But this does sound like a boy's paradise, doesn't
it? It really is. But everybody else, including the women, went to this ghastly, ghastly fate where they were overlooked by a goddess, the corpse goddess called Hel, and the corpse ripper dragon was down there feeding on you. It was not a nice fate. Now, if you are offered a choice between going and having your corpse eternally gnawed by corpse ripper, or you can go to heaven, heaven wins out every time. And because Christianity offered salvation to everybody, I mean slave and free, male and female, absolutely everybody, it has a universal appeal, which these other religions, they never quite got it. They were great for the ruling classes, because, you know, if you are the Jarl Ragnar, and it's great for you, because if you die with your sword in your hand, you're just about to go off to, you know, NFL heaven, but everybody else around you is sort of doomed. And their hell was cold, too. It was freezing cold. So you know, one lot goes to sort of Labrador, and the other lot go to a feasting hall. It's not a universal appeal.
Where do you learn these things?
Well, you learn them from the real historians.
Who are digging around writing the books that nobody else will read?
Absolutely, yes. I think that's more or less true.
What do you do? Spend your time in monographs, and then you sit down and tell a story that I and others can stay up too late reading?
Yeah, I hope so. Part of my job is to read an enormous amount of history, and that means a lot of very obscure academic stuff. And out of that, of course, you get ideas.
I don't know when the Dark Ages technically ended. There is a sense, a pervasive sort of shattering of at least the remnants of the Dark Age in the Roman buildings.
It was amazing how much Roman was in this.
That are all over. Were all over England, the Isles, and that were inaccessible, technologically inaccessible.
They were feared. There's a lovely Anglo-Saxon poem in which a man talks about this, and we think that he's writing about Bath. And Bath, of course, was an enormous Roman centre, and would have had a large number of Roman buildings that would have been decaying. The evidence, again, is that when the Romans withdrew from Britain, it was an orderly withdrawal. They took much of the lead with them from the buildings, so that basically your flashing is gone, and so the buildings start to decay. But they're still incredibly impressive. They're huge, hugely impressive.
To this day, they're pretty impressive.
To this day, some of them are, yes. And this man sits among the ruins of Roman Bath, and remember, he's there probably 300 or 400 years after the Romans have left. And he is filled with a great melancholy, because he knows that his society cannot make buildings like this. He says they're the work of giants. And he feels that inexorably mankind is sliding into a darkness, because we are losing civilization. Civilization was in the past, and what lies in the future is nothing but darkness, loneliness, and death. It's a very depressing, sad poem.
And this is a real poem.
It's a real poem, and this was a real guy, and this is what he was thinking. And I think they must have thought that. Throughout that period, once the Romans had gone, there must have been a feeling that because we cannot share, that we are sliding into barbarism and darkness. I mean, however bad things might seem to be to us in the early 21st century, there is not a feeling that we are sliding backwards.
I don't know.
There is a feeling, not to the extent that they had it, not to the extent that you went and sat in a place like Bath and you saw these enormous buildings, absolutely enormous buildings, and knew you could not make them, you could not do them, and you have no conception of how they could be done. And the Romans left stone bridges, and you know, when they decayed, they were patched up with timber. The London Bridge, the Romans built a London Bridge. By this period, it's broken. It's going to be a long time before it's mended again. And they also feared them. London was a large Roman city. And we know, for instance, it had an amphitheatre, and there were several temples. And on the whole, the Saxons didn't like to live in it. One king of Mercia did build himself a palace inside Roman London, and he probably incorporated one of the Roman buildings in his palace. But his people wouldn't live there with him, and they started up a new town, which was just to the west, which is now where the Strand is.
And you talk about that in The Last Kingdom.
And there's, when you talk about Aldwych in London, Aldwych is the 1,000-year-old English for old town, the Roman town. And the Roman town is where what we now call the City of London. Saxon London was where Trafalgar Square and Covent Garden and the Strand now is. But they would rather build a new town and live there than to live among the ghosts in Aldwych.
Bernard Cornwell is known to many people for his whole wonderful series about Sharp, and now is starting a new series that takes us to the time of King Alfred the Great. Bernard Cornwell, Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, we'll all be back in a moment. Be with us when we return.